Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Hi, I'm Scott Hahn, and I'd like to invite you personally to join me and Breadbox Media on August 24th in New Oxford, Pennsylvania, for a day of spiritual renewal. I'll be presenting three talks, one on St. Joseph, one on the sacrament of matrimony, and another one on the Holy Eucharist. Learn more and register at breadboxmedia.com/PA conference. I hope to see you there.
Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Good evening, everybody, my fellow truth seekers. Welcome to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio 980 AM on your dial. We come to you live tonight and every Sunday night between 10 p.m. and midnight. Beneath the Surface is a unique talk show. We don't gab or whine about surface political issues, but delve beneath the surface on some of the more fundamental questions of life. It's a show that, like Socrates, believes dialogue that follows reason can uncover truth, as long as fear or bias do not hinder it. And a welcome again, ladies and gentle things. Glad you could join us. I'm Paul Morano, your host on Beneath the Surface. We've got a fascinating show tonight. If I may say so myself, as always, well, at least as usual. But first, before we get into that, let us say hello to the man behind the glass. Yes, he lives behind a glass, at least 90% of the time I know him. And that is Mr. Chris Campbell, our producer. Chris. I don't hear you, Chris. Are you on? I don't hear a word of you.
Oh,
there
now
you
I'm
are.
On.
There you are.
So, Chris, how are you, Paul? How was your week?
My week was weak. How was yours?
It was good. Cramming for finals this week. Cause...
Now, do you live behind a glass, or is this just my imagination?
Well,
because the way this is set up, it's kind of like a zoo. You know, I observe you from behind a glass.
Or I observe you behind the glass.
I guess it depends on how you look at it.
Indeed.
But you're not even as interesting as a zoo animal, though. When I look at you, you're just sort of sitting there playing with gadgets. You're not. I need you to entertain me more than that if you're going to be behind the man behind the glass.
Yes, but you're the entertainer, so I'm watching you.
I'm not an entertainer. I'm just a me. So anything else new? Your week was fine?
Besides cramming, not too much.
Yeah. Well, you know what we do at this time of the night before we get into it, before we go beneath the surface on our important topic. Ladies and gentle persons, our puns of the evening. I tried on a pair of trousers in the store. It was survival of the fittest. Two scientists were stranded on a desert island. It was survival of the physicists. I opened two sodas to see which would go flat first. It was survival of the fizziest. And our joke of the evening.
Play along.
All right. Now, this is our first weekly Italian joke. And since I only have one, it's our last weekly Italian joke. All right, mystery guests, what would you rather have, a dollar or a demeter?
I don't know.
What would you rather have? You don't know?
I don't know.
Well, I'm asking you which one you'd rather have.
I'll take a dollar.
Well, do you know what both of these objects are?
Only one of them. That's why I'm choosing the known.
Well, if you were to play along with me well, you would actually ask me maybe what the one that you don't know is.
What's a dollar?
Somebody asked me the right question.
What was the question again?
I'd say, mystery guest, what would you rather have, a dollar or a demotter?
A demotter? What's a demotter?
Nothing. What's a demotter with you?
Hey. you know, with a knock-knock jokes, I always know how to respond.
My gosh, that was like pulling teeth. All right, ladies and gentlepersons, let us get to it. Our topic of the night. We go beneath the surface tonight on science and religion. And why not? What more interesting topic is there? And to make this subterranean mission with me, from left to right on your radio, is Mr. John Tutoris. John has been on Beneath the Surface a few times. He's come up for air for about a couple of months and hasn't been beneath since then. John, welcome back.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Summarize your existence for the last few months that you haven't been on the show.
Taking classes, philosophy program, and a master's program. Still taking them.
Yeah.
And still working. I work at a brokerage firm on the side.
Gotcha.
Yeah. It's good times.
I see. Any woman in the offering yet?
No sacrificial offering at this time.
No sacrificial offering? All right. And to your left and to my right, Mr. Robert LeBlanc. Bob has this this hippie look going on that I'm really interested in lately.
It's Sam Adams, I tell you.
Yeah.
With a goatee.
So
salt
he's got,
and pepper
well, he's
galore.
Got the whole it's not just a goatee, it's like a big thick goatee that's sort of salt and pepper.
He needs a puffy shirt.
And he's doing the whole ponytail thing now, which is really cool. And you've got the 1960s glasses.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're like John Lennon back in his heyday right now.
Yeah, I was kind of aiming for the Jeb Stuart look there.
Tell the audience who Jeb Stuart is.
He was a cavalry officer in the Civil War. I probably could have picked a Union guy, Custer, but he died.
Okay. So I'm off by about 100 years on the Sam Adams reference.
Oh, okay. So tonight, an interesting topic, one that I'm sure you gentlemen talk about all the time in your spare time. And I don't say that facetiously, because this is just what you folks like to talk about, as so do I. Is there a contradiction between science and faith? Is there a natural tension, or is there simply a symbiotic relationship between faith and reason or faith and science? Very important questions. I think these questions sort of came to the forefront of American consciousness during things like the Scopes monkey trial in the 19th century. And the question of Galileo, the question of evolution, and simply other questions that come up in the past couple of centuries. Sort of, it begs us to ask the question, is there any necessary tension at all between the methods of science and the methods of religious faith? The phone number here at Beneath the Surface Radio is 978-454-4980. Again, that's 978-454-4980. And you can also make a comment at facebook.com/fellowtruthseekers. All right. Gentlemen, start your engines.
Vroom, vroom, vroom.
All right. So what direction do your engines take us?
Maybe we could start off with the Cosmos TV show. That's kind of perhaps the latest entry into the genre that we're speaking of.
Okay, so Cosmos, it was an old TV show that first was hosted by Carl Sagan, and it got a lot of young people into an interest in science. It has been just, no pun intended, resurrected in lately on the, not the Science Channel, but
Fox.
Yeah. National Geographic, Fox, yeah.
And
with a new host, what was his name? Neil Grassy or something?
Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Thank you. Neil deGrasse Tyson. And it basically began, and I only saw the first show. I actually bought cable TV to see Cosmos because of the huge buildup. And, well, I have cable TV, but I bought a new package, so I paid more money. I saw the first show.
I watched the first show and the second show.
Okay, you did the second show. You did more than me. I saw the first show, and I thought it was absurd, to be honest with you, on two levels. Number one, it was an ideological, philosophical show. It was much more than it was scientific. It just wanted to puff its chest and say, we are the truth and nobody else has it. That was what I saw in that first show. And in order to do that, the producers and the writers had to try to sophomorically bring down religious faith in order to puff themselves up. That, to me, that was the first show. I didn't see the second show, and I canceled it since then. Because if I wanted to see real science, which I absolutely love, I don't know about you guys, but I love real science, I'd watch the Science Channel.
Paul, I have to agree with you. I found the shows weak on the science part. I wanted to see some really juicy stuff, and I was disappointed with the shallowness on the science side. You know, it's just like, really, you're just going to talk about this stuff, and you're not going to give us some really meaty stuff, you know, about science, and so I said, well, you know, I lost interest, you know,
not only did the ideological nonsense turn me off, but the immaturity of it. I mean, if it was going to be a show for children, bill it that way. But it didn't seem to. They didn't seem to bill it that way, John. So I was expecting this Science Channel, adult kind of science show, and I didn't get it.
I don't think the aim of the show itself is to bring in hard science per se. I mean, the ideal is that it should be there, and I can see why you and Bob and others may be disappointed. And to a degree, I think I was as well. But when I watched it, I got the impression that what they were trying to inspire in others was a certain sense of awe and beauty at the universe, which is interesting because those are philosophical things. Those are transcendentals, beauty, right? Truth, all these things that it's aspiring to, but it has some core philosophy that's off.
Okay. So you're saying that what it tries to inspire in people is a beauty and awe of the relation of the universe.
Sure.
And you're saying that is actually, ironically or coincidentally, over and above the scientific method. The scientific method simply says what is. It doesn't try to inspire. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, well, that's certainly a component of it. But I think the ideology, you know, as far as the awe goes, let's take a step back. And you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, I saw it kind of anticipating that intuitively that there would be some odd ideological points in it, but like, you know, I'm sort of a fan of movies, and sometimes I'll go see a disaster movie, not because the conclusions of it are great, but because I like to see the special effects. Okay. And so there's a certain, in a certain sense, there's an appreciation of awe, right? All these awes and wonders that go on. And to a certain degree, I thought the show kind of captured that, but where it misses it is it shoots itself in the foot by really painting a false picture, as you already acknowledged, between the connection between faith and science. And think about it, science itself would not have made the advances that it has without the virtue-laden ethics that are inherent in Christianity.
Okay, what do you mean by that? And I know people are right now, people are asking the same question. What does that have to do with the scientific method?
Sure. Well, think about fortitude, right? All right. Okay. So you get up, you try again. You get up, you try again. There's a certain aiming towards a goal of something, and knowing that you may not get it the first time, the 10th time, the 100th time, the 1,000th time, but you're aiming to progress and enter into something more deeply.
So if you, in other words, no pain, no gain. If you want to uncover lots of our quality, truth, and beauty, you have to persevere in this effort.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
The virtue of perseverance, you see, the virtue of perseverance is a Christian.
Well, it is. And the virtues themselves are sort of natural to people. I mean, even 400 years prior to the advent of Christianity, you had Aristotle talking about the virtues to such a very keen degree. But how well were a lot of them practiced, right? It wasn't until you had the fertile ground of Christianity that virtues, once Christianity started to become more widespread, that the virtue late in life really became more explicit and more commonplace amongst people. And when you have that virtue late in life, that's when advances in intellectual discoveries, scientific discoveries, become more possible. If you don't have virtues like fortitude or temperance or any of these things, you won't have the ability to come to these advances and progress going forward.
So then the human virtues are what make both, would you say, both science and arts come alive?
Oh, absolutely.
There is something to the virtue aspect. I don't think that's enough to really, because it's not virtues are not exclusively Christian, as John pointed out. We have Aristotle,
he actually was the father of the virtuous model of living. I think he was the father of virtue ethics.
Right, right. Yeah. And you see the Romans picking up on that, Cicero.
Right.
And that continued on with the Scholastic and medieval philosophers. Yes.
Adding the supernatural virtues.
Right,
in the middle.
Correct.
Yeah.
But I think the really distinctive thing about Christianity, and the pagans did have this, but it's something very true about Christianity, is the philosophical realism. What we see is actually true. What is real, and there are different philosophies, different faith views, but Christianity, I think, really stands out and says what we see is not an illusion. It is very, very real.
All right.
So we can actually do something with it. We can touch it and look at it, and it's going to be a real result. It's not going to be something that's God trying to trick us or something like that.
So I think what you're saying sounds almost obvious, but it's profound, because Eastern philosophies in the world have always believed the opposite, haven't they? The contrary.
They thought the world is an illusion. It's and in fact, you know,
and all distinctions between things are simply illusionary.
Right. Right.
Right?
There's that kind of view that God is everything. That's on top of that. So.
And so the idea of trying to reach nirvana, for example, in Buddhism, is the idea of trying to completely empty yourself of all thoughts, to recognize almost on an unconscious level that you are part of the big nothing. Or you could say the big something, which is nothing.
Right.
Because you are nothing. You are just part of the big one, the oneness of which all distinctions and all things observed are actually illusionary.
Right. But there's also this, is and especially this goes to Genesis here.
Okay.
God and creation are two separate things.
Yes.
So therefore, if you are doing science per se, you know, if you're doing science, you are not actually experimenting on God. You're experimenting on something that's not God. And so you're going to go right ahead and find out about it, and you're not committing a sacrilege.
And again, that was specifically Western, wasn't it?
Yes.
I know traditionally the Japanese, when they used to chop down trees, for example, they had to do an elaborate ritual, religious ritual in order to do that, because they believed kami, or the life of God, was the tree. And all was one, and one was God, and there wasn't that freedom that people in the West have in observing and utilizing the creation to try to understand its laws.
And so also with Christianity, we have actually one great word that's borrowed from the Greeks, logos. And you see that at the very, very beginning of John's Gospel. In the beginning was the Word. The actual Greek word is logos.
Yep.
And the logos was God. And so what we see here is that the universe is intelligible. it's reason. God is reason. Therefore, whatever he creates is a reasonable thing.
Reasonable. So this is very elementary, but very profound. It's elementary in the sense that we take it for granted. But the scientific method is something that depends on these principles, that the world is, number one, it's real. Number two, it's not God. And number three, it's very reasonable because it came from the fingertip, if you will, of God, who is himself reason.
And right? So, yes.
Okay,
so
those three principles are extremely important here.
Well, they're important if you want to see science develop. Otherwise, you would have something of faith being opposed to science. You would say, oh, we can't experiment on this. It would be a sacrilege to experiment.
It would either be a sacrilege, or we would get nothing out of it,
right,
or we would be deceiving ourselves.
Absolutely.
Because faith, in a sense, underlies science, in as much as you have to believe. First of all, you have to believe your five senses. You have to have faith in that. That my observational powers will enable me to obtain some kind of truth. That's a faith. I mean, Descartes, for example, didn't necessarily, at least one point in his life, did not believe in his senses. Right?
Right. Well, there is this thread of skepticism that's going through philosophies, even the pre-Socratics, there were skeptics at the time, and you would say that Socrates was kind of a skeptic, but he was kind of the right sort of skeptic.
Well, he was the right sort of skeptic in as much as he was challenging the status quo thinking of his time,
right?
And the so-called experts of his time. But he never contradicted reason.
No. Yeah. But I mean, a lot of people confused him as a kind of a skeptic, as a sophist. But that skepticism proceeded through, you know, some Roman philosophers and philosophies, and we actually see it mature in Hume, and I'm actually kind of surprised that Hume just didn't break the entire thing apart.
Okay, in one sentence for the audience, how would you summarize the philosophy of skepticism?
Radical skepticism really just is doubting everything, you know, absolutely. You can't trust your senses.
Yeah.
You can't trust anything outside of you.
So you're literally skeptical about everything because everything almost comes down to faith, doesn't it? You have to have faith in your senses in order to even start to believe that you can know anything outside of yourself.
Yes. I mean, you have to have some sort of I guess you would say, faith that you can know things outside yourself.
So science depends on non-skepticism. In other words, science depends on an underlying kind of faith.
Yes, I think there's kind of a middle path that you take. I think a lot of scientists would say we're skeptics as well. So there's you can't be a radical skeptic is I guess what I'm trying to say is, rather than to say, oh, you know, I have complete faith in this, it's rather we understand that our knowledge is limited. We understand that our senses are limited.
Yeah.
But it is not radical in the sense that we can't trust anything
all right.
at all.
And there's that middle ground. The senses don't you can't fully trust them 100% to give you the absolute truth and everything you see and observe. And on the other hand, you have to at least begin to believe it, just like we do in our everyday lives. We wouldn't get out of bed if we didn't trust our senses.
Right.
All right.
Is the floor really there for my foot to head on?
Mm. Okay, so then.
Well, I think I would like to continue on.
Yeah.
There is that you find actually the scholastics, and especially Thomas Aquinas, who is actually, I think, really at a turning point, because Aristotle was being reintroduced to the West during that time.
Oh, and just real briefly, Bob, for those who aren't familiar, who would the scholastics be in general?
Well, they would be mostly churchmen. They would be people, the intellectual class, the university
of the Middle Ages.
Of the Middle Ages, yeah.
Okay.
I think the high point is basically Thomas Aquinas. There's Bonaventure. There's Albert the Great.
Okay.
But
and Aquinas was said to have been the great synthesizer.
Yes, he
not in as much as he was an organ that played music.
Right, right.
He synthesized religious faith and reason. To which the Greeks had given civilization.
Yeah, there was a kind of like a split that was starting to happen among scholars at the time.
Mm.
You know, and we're not just talking Christian. There were Muslims involved as well. And basically, some people were saying, well, there's the truth of faith, and then there's the truth of science.
Yeah.
And they're saying, you could believe one thing when you put your science hat on, and you could believe
right.
something completely different when you put your religious hat on.
And they don't necessarily have to connect in any way or correlate in any way. Okay.
And this is something that got Saint Thomas Aquinas very animated. He's going, no.
There's only one truth.
There's only one truth. We only have one God. There is only one truth.
And what Aquinas is saying is that these are two legitimate avenues
right.
to attempting to attain that one truth.
Yes, right. He saw them as kind of two paths of seeing the one truth, but they were not two separate truths, but rather one truth.
So these paths, John, they according to that school of thought, are meant to be complementing each other and sort of honing each other to become closer to the truth.
Well, yeah. I mean, all truth is one. Yeah. And to maybe step back just a hair, because if someone just hops in on our broadcast right now and hears Thomas Aquinas saying, well, he's a saint, he's a churchman, right? Is he just, he might be a smart guy. I've never read his stuff. Where is he pulling all this stuff from? It's important to note that he actually pulled a very big influence. Going back to what Bob was saying before about from Aristotle. Aristotle was around 400 years before Christianity and he was, to a certain extent, the originator of a lot of disciplines that we take for granted now. And he, employing the principle of non-contradiction, would also have said that there should be no distinction between truth. Truth is one.
All right, we need to take a quick break, but that's a good introduction to our show tonight on science and religion. And we're going to talk about a lot more involved in this. I do want to ask John about this notion of the law of non-contradiction and how we can know anything, really. How does the human being, how are we certain about anything? We'll get into that and a lot more here on Beneath the Surface tonight, Sunday evening. The time is 10:30. We're going to take a quick break for commercials and be back. Stay with us.
Are you pregnant, scared, overwhelmed, or feeling pressured? There is free, confidential caring help available to you. You're not alone. Call Heartbeat at 781-229-7887.
Heartbeat made me feel comfortable and was supportive.
I received so much help from them.
They were understanding, not judgmental.
It was a warm, friendly, supportive atmosphere. They did not judge.
If you are in the midst of an unintended pregnancy, need help, or are seeking answers, you're not alone. Heartbeat is there for you, confidentially and without judgment. Pick up the phone and call 781-229-7887. You'll be so happy you did. That's 781-229-7887. 229-7887. Heartbeat Pregnancy Help Center. People you can trust. 781-229-7887.
And a welcome back. Glad you stayed with us. 10:35 here at WCAP, where everybody gets it. Lowell, Massachusetts. You're either listening to us via radio waves or via the computer, which you can find us at www.980wcap.com. And all you have to do is hit the Listen Live button or on the TuneIn application. We are talking tonight on Beneath the Surface about the question of science and religion. And to go beneath the surface with me on this important topic, and I say very, and I think it's a very important topic since all the false polarities that have been happening in the past half a century or so have been pitting against, usually religious fundamentalists against scientific positivists, and we'll get into what both of those things mean in a little while. But suffice it to say, at least at this moment, that they are two false polarities. My name is Paul Morano. I'm here with John Tudoris and Bob LeBlanc. Gentlemen, where do we go from here?
Well, we last left off. I touched on Aristotle, who's around about 400 years BC, yep. So before Christianity. Even actually, interestingly enough, before the interaction with the Jews and the Greeks, he was actually the instructor of Alexander the Great. So that's what kind of led to the whole Hellenization of the Western world at the time. So we know historically that there's actually a disconnect there. They were not, the Greeks were not a monotheistic people.
However, when you say that through Alexander the Great was the Hellenization of the world, the known world at the time, you're talking about a Greek way of looking at things, a rational, philosophical understanding of the world.
Yes. Okay. Yes, that's part and parcel. When his empire spread, Greek stuff, Greek culture spread out through it, language, ways of doing things, philosophy. And that's just an important backdrop. We don't want to get too much in it. It'll take us away from the topic. But it's important to establish that as a point in history to acknowledge that the monotheism of the Jews was not interacting before then with the Greeks.
Yes.
And so we have a certain understanding here, even before delving too deeply into it, to say that when Aristotle's coming to his conclusions here on this oneness of truth, or that, for example, that there has to be a first principle of everything, which is a one God, he's doing this outside of the influence of the Jews, which were okay. The only monotheistic culture in the known world at the time.
Okay, so then the Greeks, like virtually everyone else in the world before Judaism and Christianity infiltrated the world or permeated the world, was polytheistic.
Yes.
They believed they had their pantheon of gods, just like all of the ancient world did.
Yeah.
And so their principles that laid part of the foundation of what we now know as science or the scientific method were human principles. They were natural principles.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, just to put an exclamation mark on what John has said, or to underline it, is basically reason and faith have arrived at a single point of agreement that there is one God.
which, by the way, was a topic for our natural theology show a few months prior. But I mean, to get back to the thing of the one truth.
Yeah.
So Aristotle's principle of non-contradiction. So to those who aren't familiar with it, basically something cannot be and not be at one and the same time and in the same respect. So what does that mean? You know, for example, I have this microphone right in front of me. It's not a bottle of water. It is at this one place in time, a microphone. Well, people might say, well, no, duh, John, of course it is. I can see with my own two eyes.
Yeah.
And that's important because we're acknowledging the objective reality of the existence of this one microphone in this certain place in time.
Yeah.
And so it's not something else. And we oftentimes take that at face value. That is not often extrapolated and carried through in our thought process to the larger things.
Well, it's interesting how we tend to be uncomfortable with contradiction. And it seems to me that before philosophy made its impact in the world, I don't think people were all too uncomfortable with contradiction, were they?
No, I can't speak to that.
Okay.
I would say there's a certain something to that.
And it seems to me like more and more today, there seems to be less and less a discomfort with contradiction, with the way people think.
Well, there's a reintroduction of prior philosophies which allowed for contradiction, so to speak, at least through our education systems. For example, yeah. Bob was talking about the skepticism that came about, you know, through philosophers like David Hume, Descartes, Immanuel Kant's another big one. Those are all in the 17th century.
Yeah.
And, of course, the Greeks had that a few thousand years beforehand. So it's sort of like a reintroduction, so to speak, of those philosophies. But the context ends up being different because, in a certain sense, they start off with a reaction against what was thought to be objective truth to a degree. And then, of course, they don't really understand what they're objecting against fully. So that's why there's all sorts of confusion and they're reacting off of each other.
I also see that the contradiction isn't immediate. I think what makes things a little more complicated these days is that you need to follow through on your thought,
yep.
And then eventually the contradiction appears or doesn't appear. And I think a lot of people live in the contradiction because they haven't actually thought things through to their logical conclusion.
Oh, Bob, that's just your opinion.
Well, let's talk about this. Let's talk about the three ways to certitude. There are three avenues to truth that every human being has, whether they realize it or not. And that is the empirical avenue, which can be seen as scientific also, the scientific method. There's the rational or rational thought, which is reason, and there's the method of certitude through faith or sound belief. So you have science, reason, and faith, the empirical, the rational, and the faithful, if you will. Now, we know everything through these three methods, don't we? In other words, I see it, therefore I believe it. I think it through, like you just mentioned. Or I have heard it on the word of somebody else, and I believe it. Now, what's interesting about these three methods to certitude is that they're all undergirded by faith. Like we mentioned earlier in this show, you have to believe, A, your senses in order to have any faith in the scientific method, and B, your ability to reason. If you're going to have any faith in your thinking or the rational method.
I see what you're saying. The interesting thing is that a lot of people refuse to acknowledge the faith. They want to say faith is blind. They want to talk about a faith that is irrational.
That's devoid of reason. You're right.
That is devoid of reason. So I think the common or one of the common humanist or atheistic memes is the flying spaghetti monster.
The FSM.
Yeah, the FSM, which is a really irrational sort of thing. You know,
right.
This is like, really? I mean, there's somebody out there who believes in a flying spaghetti monster?
Can I examine this for a second? Why are there so many people that go to this extreme in order to make a point? Why do they believe that faith is devoid of all reason? Where does this come from?
Well, I think they think of people of faith as silly, without reason.
But don't they know that they are people of faith? Without admitting it.
Well, I think they're not admitting it is the real point. That
right.
They would deny that there's really any faith involved. I think they would use a different word. I think they, rather than faith, they would say, well, I trust this.
Well, trust is faith.
Well, I think part of the problem is, and actually before we came here, just a little disclosure, Bob and I were kind of warming up with a little chitter-chatter in the car. And I think a lot of it has to do with a misunderstanding of what faith really is. You mentioned before blind faith, and to a certain degree, faith always has an amount of blindness in it. I mean, that's part and parcel with it, but the blind faith that's in that caricature that's often perceived as, you know, what Bill Maher say, faith is for people who don't think, and he's at least in that statement like that, would be saying that faith is just sort of this caricature of people who don't have any way to think, so they're blindly believing in something. Well, that's actually completely contrary to the real truth of what faith is. Faith in itself employs our reason. Without our sound reason, we wouldn't have, we wouldn't need faith to connect to certain things.
Not only that, say the statement that Bill Maher said again.
Oh, faith is for people who don't think.
Now, is he proposing that for us to believe it?
That is an interesting question.
And does he believe it himself, that statement?
I don't know if he's actually said that or
well,
not.
Well, of course, obviously he believes that statement in order to make it, right? Well, so what he's saying is he's a non-thinker. Because in order for him to make that statement, he has to believe it.
Well, here's the other thing is...
Do you see the inherent contradiction?
It's a selective usage of the term faith.
Yeah.
When they're saying faith, at least in what I've observed, not just with people like Bill Maher, but either other people that, you know, for example, you go on some of the Facebook debates that we see, they'll apply only to things having to do with religion. And it stops right there. If you try and take that word and its meaning and apply it to other things.
Okay, then why the irrational fear regarding religion? I mean, I'm trying to get beneath the surface of this nonsense.
Well, people have to trust. It's a matter of grasping.
But these same people that have their irrational fear of religion have no problem trusting in other ways of thinking.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, I think Paul knows where I'm going to go here because we've been involved in the same sort of discussion, is how do we know a lot of things that we actually know?
Yeah.
And a lot of these things are sourced through the first point of certainty, empiricism, or the empirical.
I see it, therefore I believe it, right?
The thing is that they receive that secondhand. A lot of people know the things that they know from science, not from direct observation or experiment.
Or direct evidence.
It came from a scientist. It could have came, it could have came from...
A false scientist, for all we know. Or a real scientist.
A real scientist. Right. But they know this scientific fact.
Yes.
Through faith.
They're certain,
It came secondhand. They trust the person that gave them that scientific fact.
Or third hand, or 5,000th hand.
Yes, but it's not directly there. But they look at the source and say, this is not a faith thing.
Right.
Rather than acknowledging the fact that it was a teacher or a book or a movie or whatever secondhand source that told them about this particular fact.
I hope everybody listening appreciates the utter contradiction that you're bringing up here. That 90-some-odd% of what people believe they are certain about is not firsthand.
But they trust the source.
They believe the source, whether that medium be a book, a teacher, a parent, a so-called scientist of the Middle Ages, a historian of ancient times. I believe Alexander the Great, John, conquered the known world at the time. Why do I believe that? I didn't see it, right? I have trust, I have faith in the people that were there at the time and all of the subsequent people that wrote about that historical. It could be completely false, but my faith tells me to accept that. It's a matter of faith, isn't it, Bob?
The thing is, especially like history. History is, I think, something that's very close to the transmission of faith that we see in the world today.
Called tradition. Yeah.
Basically, tradition. The information is handed down through generation, through generation, through generation.
Yeah.
History does the same exact thing. We know about the Roman Empire because people who knew about were living in the Roman Empire passed down the information of the Roman Empire down to the next generation, down to the next generation.
All right, so let's break this down again. I have no direct evidence of the Roman Empire, right? I have no direct
evidence. You personally do not have
none.
Any, yes.
Okay. This is what I have to trust in order to believe it. And by the way, I do believe it. I need to trust books. I need to trust ancient maps. I need to trust ancient historians. I need to trust what some people now are saying as ancient artifacts. I need to trust all of this. I need to put my faith in these people, right?
Well, even if you had an artifact in front of you, you would have to have all these supporting beliefs around it in order to recognize it for what it is.
Right.
I mean, if you saw a piece of pottery and said, oh, this is a Roman piece of pottery, therefore the Roman Empire existed. Well, wait a second. You know, you have to believe in the Roman Empire first in order to identify that piece of pottery as a Roman piece of pottery. You know what I'm saying? There's a whole bunch of things that lead into and confirm that this is a piece of evidence.
So then, let's bring this a little bit full circle then. Why are there a lot of people who are ready to give their blind faith to the fact, for example, that Alexander the Great conquered the known world in 300 BC or whenever it was, and they are very reticent to give their informed faith to Jesus of Nazareth rising from the dead?
That radically changes their life if they do so.
Ah, I need to pause there. That's profound. So in other words, if I put my faith in the historical fact of Alexander the Great and what he did, I don't have to change my personal life.
No, you don't.
I can still continue my life of vice, whatever that might be.
Sure.
Okay. But you're saying that if I do accept and believe that Jesus of Nazareth rose from the dead and is now gloriously ascended into heaven, that changes my I would have to change my comfort zone?
Oh, absolutely. And one principal reason why is because Christianity alone, amongst all other religions, is the one that demands a personal relationship with your God, period. Okay. And in order to do that, you have to enter into that relationship, your entire being. And if you don't actually even attempt to pursue that...
So then I don't have to enter into a relationship with Alexander the Great if I believe that historical fact of him.
Exactly.
But with Jesus of Nazareth, you're saying I would have to.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a twist here, Paul,
okay.
I think.
What's that, Bob?
And I think I've noticed it, especially when we're talking about secular historians and the difference what they look at and what we would look at as people of faith. And the thing is that a secular historian would deny that miracles can happen.
Okay.
They would start off with that ground. So basically, if you were talking to a secular scholar, he would talk about Jesus. He'd say Jesus existed. That's a very, you know, that's, you have to believe that if you're a reasonable historian, because there's so much evidence out there that Jesus existed.
Okay.
And
he
walked the earth, and he was crucified. I think that's the bare minimum.
Whether you have faith or not, that's a universal understanding.
That's a universal understanding. But then you go to the resurrection, and that's something that a secular historian will not
accept. Why?
Because that's kind of in the miracle sort of thing.
So
that's what I'm trying to say is this is to me, it's you cannot prove whether a miracle can occur or cannot occur.
Can I say
something? They start from that basis and say miracles can occur, therefore we're going to discount it.
Contradictory to me. These same folks would believe in the miracle of inorganic life becoming organic life. They would believe that non-existence of being would all of a sudden become being in what we call a Big Bang. They would understand that animal life would all of a sudden become intelligent life. All of these things that are accepted on faith that these people believe are miracles.
They are miracles. They would probably say that there's some sort of natural explanation that we haven't found out about it yet, so therefore those sorts of things aren't miracles.
But they're obviously as much miracle as somebody like Jesus rising from the dead. Couldn't you make the same arguments that maybe there's a way that we can understand Jesus rising from the dead?
Well, perhaps in line with that, and I just want to maybe back up or hit a slight tangent just in order to perhaps answer that a bit better. And I want to get back to the second of the three ways to know truth that you mentioned before, which
is
the rational one.
Yeah.
And I think that...
Human reason.
My two cents is one reason why there is this disconnect amongst people who would accept Alexander the Great but not Jesus, or accept... the scientific method or the Big Bang, but not accept, you know, the first principle of anything is because the reason isn't formed well enough.
Their reason isn't formed well
enough. Their reason is not formed well enough. For example, an argument now, in general, you ask people what an argument is,
yeah,
they'll think it's one-upmanship. They'll think it's I'm shouting louder than you.
Yeah.
What they don't understand is argument in a more classical sense, meaning in a rightly ordered sense, is actually people reasoning through something.
In order to attain the truth together.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
It's not a competition between two people. It's a competition between the two people and falsehood. They're trying to understand, uncover truth together.
We're actually
back to the pre-Socratics again, the sophists, and who were basically guaranteeing people they were being paid to teach people how to win arguments, not to arrive at truth.
Oh, sure.
So this false understanding of argument was around ever since ancient times.
I think these ideas are as old as ever as far as this is concerned.
And this is why Socrates is so important, isn't he? And that's why I open my show every week with mentioning Socrates. That Socrates believed that argumentation was two people of good faith together seeking truth and hoping to uncover it more and more together. And that's really what Beneath the Surface is all about, trying to uncover truth together as a team of sincere truth seekers. And isn't that what it's all about?
Oh, absolutely. And one more thing I just want to add too about the point of our reason not being formed well enough.
Yeah.
Is that, and this is perhaps where there's also a disconnect, is that oftentimes what people think is reasoning things out falls into the bucket of, well, that's your opinion.
Yeah.
And they're not recognizing things as objective truth outside of a person. I hold on to something. And that goes back to the modernist philosophers, particularly Immanuel Kant in the 17th century, who are really kind of pinpointing it to the person as the source rather than and their impression of things rather than the objective truth outside of a person.
Well, this goes back to what we talked about earlier, that you really have to trust that your senses and your reason can uncover truth, not just opinion, not just what I desire, not just what I want, but actually the truth of being outside of myself. And the truth of what I hear right now outside of myself is our song that is leading us to our first big break. You are listening to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio. A good discussion so far about science and religion. 2 minutes, says my producer. Okay, so I have 2 minutes to kill, even though my favorite song of the 1970s is playing. But so far that we're talking about the three avenues to certainty about anything, and that is faith, reason, and science, and how all three are meant to help each other to the one truth. And the false polarity, and I want to get more and more into that next hour, about the false polarity between fideism and scientism. The idea that that these things are supposed to be individual and not connect, having no connection to each other. Of course, we are going to get into the question of evolution next hour, as well as other controversial issues here on Beneath the Surface Radio. So let us listen to the news together, see what's new out there in the world, and then come back in about 3 or 4 minutes. I'm Paul Morano. I'm here with John Tudoris and Bob LeBlanc, and I hope you're enjoying the show. See you in a few minutes. And a good evening, everybody. Welcome back to Beneath the Surface, hour number two. here at BTS Radio, 5 minutes past the hour of 11 o'clock. And I'm having fun. I hope you are too, whether you are in a car, in bed, sitting on a couch, standing around and pacing, whatever else you might be doing. We are sitting here in a studio enjoying our conversation on science and religion, trying to understand the problem that some people have today in accepting both of these as not contradicting each other. And we ask for any of your comments if you want to give us a call to give us your take on whether the methods of faith and reason or faith and science are complementary or contradictory. What do you think? The number here is 978-454-4980. 978-454-4980 if you want to make a comment or a question. My guests here are John Tudoris and Bob LeBlanc. 978-454-4980 here at BTS Radio. All right, gentlemen. Are your engines started again?
Yeah.
They're revving.
They're revving?
They're so revved.
All right. John Tudoris, Bob LeBlanc, my guests tonight. Where did we leave off?
Reason.
Reason.
One of the reasons for disconnect is actually a lack of formation of good reason.
Wait a minute. Why does... Doesn't reason come natural to us? In other words, this notion of formation of reason. Isn't human reason what makes us human, what makes us different from all the other animals? Doesn't it come natural?
Rational animal.
Yeah, we are a rational animal.
Man.
So then, to downplay reason, you would say, is to downplay what makes us human and bring us to the level of an animal.
What I suppose would be getting at on this is that, yes, reason is inherent to man. It's sort of intuitively there, built into us. But like anything about us, it needs a certain formation, right? So think about a young girl, right?
Yeah.
Instinctively within her, she has maternal instincts.
Okay.
But if, let's say, she gets married at 15 with no help, no formation from her mother or other women on how to be a good mother,
okay,
and she just has children, she's going to be kind of making stuff up as she goes along off of those sort of instincts that are built within her. So point being is that our nature as humans is progressive. We need to learn things as we go along. There needs to be a certain formation. Our minds need to be formed. That's why we go to school, right?
Okay, so then we have the potentiality that other animals don't have.
Yes.
And that needs to be fostered. It needs to be, we need formation.
Yes.
And trying to make that more mature and more apt to...
Yes. And the point being is that
the tools of
that formed reason,
yeah,
the as far as sharpening that intellect, that foundation has been to a certain degree absent. I mean, I still remember from grade school and secondary school where they ask you to write a paper,
okay,
and it's not so much on how well your reason comes to a conclusion, but maybe on the certain eloquence of your writing.
Yeah, it was a technique.
Yeah. And if you had an opinion of something, that was okay as long as,
wow,
you defended it. But even your defending of that,
yeah,
could be using faulty reasoning. But as long as you cite a certain amount of sources,
right,
that's okay as long as you fulfill.
Interesting. That's not my experience at all. And what we have, maybe 10 years between us, I do remember actually being taught how to compose an essay. And you would have to have a certain... start off a theme, so to speak,
yeah,
some sort of thesis.
Yeah.
And then you'd have paragraphs, and each paragraph would have, a sentence that would,
yeah,
kind of tell you what the entire paragraph is going to be about, and each sentence is supposed to support that first sentence.
Okay.
And each paragraph is supposed to support the argument.
All right. So we're getting a little afar here. I think the point here is that you begin with a premise, you reason properly, and you conclude properly, right?
Yes.
The problem is, and we see this with political debates all the time, and this is why I don't want to do a normal, everyday talk show, because people begin with different premises, And even though their reasoning follows those premises, they will never see eye to eye because they're beginning with different premises. They're going to come to different conclusions.
Yes.
And they argue against this, and it's impossible to argue against this. What you need to do is go beneath the surface and challenge the premises. Correct?
Yes, I agree.
Because if you begin with a false premise, you're gonna come to a false conclusion after reasoning perfectly between premise and conclusion.
What came to mind, why I'm smiling, and nobody else can see that, but Paul can see that, is
and I believe my eyes, by the way, in seeing that.
One of the things I remembered is that Saturday Night Live skit, and it was a continuing skit between Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin. I'm not sure if I can say the words on air.
Hey, it's 10 past 11. Go for it.
I think Dan Aykroyd would say...
It was point and counterpoint.
Yeah, point and counterpoint. Yeah. And Dan Aykroyd would say, Jane, you ignorant slut, or something like that.
That's how he would begin.
Was how he'd begin. He would reply with some sort of insult herself.
Yes.
And that was supposedly a mockery of political debate of the time. Or
yes.
Actually, maybe it was a little bit accurate a prophecy, you know.
Well, you know, if you're going to be a sincere truth seeker, you can never attack the person. In fact, you should never attack any individual persons. You need to attack the issues. So, getting back to what we were talking about, reason is what makes us human. It differentiates us from all the other animals that live on instinct rather than reason. But human reason needs to begin with true, sound premises. How do you do that?
You know, the very interesting thing is that all these fields of knowledge, we talk about science, we talk about mathematics, and these are like two of the most people feel most certain with dealing both with these things. Well, mathematics starts with unproven axioms, right at the very, these principles that you can't proceed any further without accepting these axioms. You can't go to the theorems that math has, or in science, the scientific method itself, great method. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it.
Yeah, awesome.
But can you prove it? You know, can you prove the scientific method by itself? Yes, by experience, we seem to have gotten some sort of certainty from it, but...
What do you mean by that? I think you're onto something profound, but I don't think you're explaining it well. You're saying that the scientific method is based on proof, right?
Well,
and you're asking, can you prove that?
Well, method itself, you do an experiment...
Yeah.
And then you try to verify this experiment. And you try to look for holes in your reasoning process, so to speak. So other people try to copy what you're doing and see if this relates a truth, so to speak. But this is a method that you're using. It's not actually something... You can't use the scientific method on the scientific method is what I'm trying to say.
Okay, so in other words, you can't prove the scientific method by the scientific method.
Right.
Okay, so then I think this is what you're getting at, and I think I'm accepting it, and that is that you have to begin with faith in the scientific method in order to believe in scientific conclusions.
Yes.
Okay.
That seems to be pretty simple. You start with these... assumptions that are very reasonable. I'm not saying
they're not illogical. They're not unreasonable. Right.
But you don't have a way of proving it.
Right. By virtue of beginning with these presumptions, they are faith presumptions that you have no way of using the scientific method to prove.
That's exactly what I'm trying to say.
Yes.
John. Just to add to that and perhaps extend it to, so that would cover of the three ways to know truth.
Yeah. Yep.
That would be the first way, the empirical.
Yes.
Interestingly enough, when it comes to the rational reason,
that
also relies on the exact same thing. Someone, in order to reason through something, has to accept on principle, for example, the law of non-contradiction.
Yes.
That something is something and not something else.
Right.
In order to come to reason to something else.
Yeah, in order to use any kind of logic. So basically, you can't contradict reason.
So of the three ways to come to know truth, the imperial, the rational, and then the faith all require faith.
Yes, that's what I said last hour. I don't know if anyone
I got
can
it. Read
I heard
it.
You, Paul. I heard you, Paul.
I heard you. But for those who didn't listen to it before, this is a recap.
Look, this is the bottom line. We are a believing species.
Oh, yes.
We are a believing species. And I don't just mean an instinctual species that lives on their instinct as a sort of a programmed physiological object. We're a believing species, which has to do with the will, doesn't it?
I think, Paul, the problem is when you say believing and faith, they're thinking of something different. They're thinking of it being irrational, not rational. When you're saying faith, I think you're talking about a rational faith. Something is very rational or reasonable to believe in something.
All right, let's get back to why these scientific positivist, what I call scientific fundamentalists, because that's really what they are, have created this polarity with religious fundamentalists. Let's look at this false polarity that is out there in the media, that the media is asking us to choose one or the other. And of course, what they're saying is you really got to choose the scientific method because the other polarity is silly.
Well,
let's look at both of the silliness of these two extremes.
There actually is a little bit of the truth in this false polarity. I mean, we have something.
In other words, there are people out there that believe this.
There are actual players out there that will be on the science side, and then there'll be players on the faith side.
So there are religious fundamentalists out there, no question, and there are scientific fundamentalists out there, or what rather should be called scientific positivists.
Right.
Okay. Now, I think most people understand the term religious fundamentalist. They will take their religious documents in a 21st century literalist fashion and have no room for reason or science, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. That's pretty much known by most people. Let's look at the definition of what I would call a secular fundamentalist or somebody who believes in scientism rather than science itself. Look at this extreme and define it for me.
Wow, that was a pitch. All right, so extreme. So
not this extreme. We already looked at religious fundamentalists. Yeah. What's the other extreme? What does that look like?
Perhaps if we're going to talk about scientism, just briefly, we'll talk
scientific
about
positivism.
Positivism itself.
Okay, what does this mean? Because this is the other extreme we're talking about.
Positivism itself was an actual movement started in the late 1800s, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And it actually was a religion. It was a religion, but then actually looked at sort of science and the humanities as sort of its end goal.
Actually, that's very honest of it to call it a religion because it's based on faith principles.
Well, it is actually. Yeah. And they even had a liturgical calendar, and instead of having saints on it, they would have, for example, William Shakespeare. This is his feast day, or some other scientist or humanist. Of course, what they're not realizing their contradiction on is that people like William Shakespeare had loads of faith.
Right.
It drips in his writings.
Let's get the difference between science and scientific positivism. What's the difference?
Right. Well, the positivism itself was the roots of the scientism that we see now.
Yes.
So it basically codifies as a religion, basically an adoration of science and the humanities.
All right. So it goes beyond the scientific method. It goes beyond observation, experimentation, hypotheses, etc. It goes beyond that, doesn't it?
Yes. It basically takes, in a certain sense, science as your end-all, be-all for knowing truth.
Well, it creates faith doctrines from science.
It does.
Okay.
For example, if I don't see it, I don't believe it. If I can't measure it, cut it, touch it, if it doesn't fit into any certain categories, it doesn't exist.
Right.
Even though they operate in the realm of taking on faith, as you acknowledged earlier, that certain things have to exist in order for them to even reason to that conclusion.
Yeah.
Well, they're also having a faith that there's nothing beyond the material world.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is not a scientific statement. That's a faith statement.
That's a faith statement. They can't prove that through science.
And that is really in the realm of religion, if you want to look at it in terms of
philosophy too.
Yeah, that's the proposition that all reality can be observed through the scientific method is a faith statement. That's not a scientific statement.
And it's an unreasonable faith statement.
So it's an unreasonable faith statement that's not at all scientific. So in other words, a lot of these secular fundamentalists that are scientific positivists, I know these are fancy terms, but that are on the extreme polarity favoring science today, are actually rejecting the scientific method when they make these assertions.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
They're not using the scientific method to make those assertions.
That's what I meant to say, yes. All right, so then they are making faith doctrines, saying that if you don't believe my faith doctrine, then you are wrong. Now, this is exactly what religious fundamentalists do. They have their faith doctrines, and they're saying if you don't believe my faith doctrines, then you are wrong, leaving no room for all three of these avenues to truth to work together. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I agree with you on that.
I think you should spell that out, Paul.
Spell it out?
Yeah.
I thought I just did.
Oh, okay.
Okay, even more? Well, basically, you can say that religious fundamentalism is a kind of fideism, which means that I put all of my trust in reality in a kind of blind, non-reasonable, non-scientific faith. The other extreme would say, of scientism, would say that I put all of my faith, all of my accepting of reality in this one particular method that the human senses can observe. And outside of that, I will say fundamentally that nothing else can be true or asserted, and if you are to the extreme, then nothing else exists. Both of these extremes our faith without reason.
I would agree.
So then let's get back to that first episode of Cosmos of a couple of months ago.
They were talking about this guy called Bruno. I've forgotten what his first name is, but his last name was Bruno.
Yeah.
And
Giordano Bruno or something like that?
Something like that,
okay.
Yeah. And it was kind of funny that they were... They acknowledged that he was a mystic, and he came up with this this view of the world not through the scientific method. It was really just an intuition, and they pointed out that he was burned at the stake by the Catholic Church. Which was, in a certain funny kind of sense, they're trying to say, well, look, you know, the church is hostile to science, but they really didn't do a very good job of it, especially in this case, because Bruno was really tried for heresies. He was actually making statements against the faith. He denied the Trinity, and I believe he denied the incarnation of Christ.
Yeah.
And all these various religious theological things that he was burned at the stake for. He was not burned at the stake for this intuition that he had I think the intuition that he had is there are many possible universes, which is actually kind of another kind of shaky scientific speculation kind of thing, because there's certainly no proof that there's these multiple worlds
It's just a theory.
It's just a theory, it was interesting. They had this cartoon, and maybe John can address they had Robert Bellarmine, who was a bishop, leading the Inquisition, and he was, you know, with this dark face. You could tell that he was supposed to be the evil character. He was
don't forget the scowl on his face.
He had a scowl, And Bruno was this, like, happy, cheery, hippie guy who was saying, you know, peace, love, and everything in the universe.
He's
like
actually
this.
Portrayed as kind of a hippie Saint Francis, believe it or not.
He did
That's
look like that.
That's one of the impressions
that
I got.
Yeah, that was funny.
But when it came down to it, you know, they really had no foundation because they had to admit that Bruno was not a scientist. He was not burned at the stake because he was a scientist, but it was all part of this kind of thing, you know, this meme that secular humanists have that say, you know, religion is hostile toward science. Therefore,
it was a straw man.
It almost seems like they need that in order to feel good about what they're doing.
Yeah, it's a very strange thing.
Psychological. Fascinating psychological phenomenon that.
Well, yeah, it's like we went against the odds and we overcame this terrible, you know, oppressive faith kind of thing. But the funny thing
is not to mention that it was like you know, 1,000 years ago.
Yeah. The other thing is that, you know, if religion and faith were at such odds, you wouldn't be grasping at Bruno. I mean, this is such a weak foundation to say that there's such hostility. Bruno and who else? Well, Galileo. Well, there's a little bit better. Well, Galileo was actually a scientist.
Yes.
But there's a long story about that. Basically, you know, Galileo, you know, well, he was preaching a new science, and the scientists that the church listened to at the time said, no, he's wrong. You know, science doesn't turn on a pin, basically. You know, it takes time for the new truths to gain acceptance. And this is really what happened at the time. So basically the scientific consensus at the time, because really telescopes were brand new at the time, was that Aristotle was right. And if you didn't agree with Aristotle, you were wrong.
I wonder if there's something even more going on here with that series, especially that first one.
You mean propaganda?
A propaganda that's not just a propaganda, but something that is an underlying agenda here. If you noticed, and I sort of jotted these down when I was watching that first Cosmos episode because I couldn't believe what I was seeing. This Bruno was being brought in on a donkey. What does that remind you of?
It's a Christ figure.
Who was brought in on a donkey on Palm Sunday?
Jesus.
There was a... let's see. He was considered martyred. He turned his head from a crucifix. Do you remember that?
No, I didn't.
They were trying to push a crucifix. This cartoon was trying to push a crucifix on
him. Yeah, he turned his head against a crucifix.
Yes. He turned his... He entered into an infinite world with arms outstretched. Do you remember that?
He was crucified himself.
Yeah, he was crucified. Yeah, as if they made him out to be a Jesus character. And all before this, they had a tribute to Carl Sagan on a rock that almost looked like Caesarea Philippi in the Gospel of Matthew, of which Carl Sagan was like the god and this Bruno character was the Christ figure who was sacrificed for the religion of science. It was really uncanny what they were actually doing, trying to create the religion of scientism, which if you really look at it, it is a religion. But in order for them to feel good about the religion of scientism, they have to try, or at least attempt to squash Christianity in order to do that.
Yeah. Well, there is a real basis of contention, at least, between the scientific fundamentalists and the fundamentalists themselves. The fundamentalists are kind of late to the story. They come in about, I think, maybe 40 years after evolution is...
You mean the religious fundamentalists? Religious fundamentalism was a reaction to what you're saying, right?
Yes. You have Charles Darwin coming up with a theory of evolution, not the first theory of evolution. I want to point that out because a lot of people think that Charles Darwin just came up with it and overturned all of religion. But The truth is there were previous theories of evolution that were not controversial at the time. Really, what was controversial about Charles Darwin's theory of evolution was the fact that God does not exist.
Okay.
Basically, he was saying that evolution occurred, natural selection occurred through random process. And basically, if it's a random process, that shows that, therefore, not God. I don't agree with that line of reasoning, but that's basically what Charles Darwin was saying, is that we have proof that God does not exist through evolution.
Now, the random you're speaking about there, Bob, and we talked about this a little before the show, wasn't like a statistics type of random. It was a more of like an I don't know type of random. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. Basically, I guess the religious point of view is that God planned everything out. And now that you have evolution with all these this natural selection being random, therefore God doesn't have a plan, therefore it's not God. That sort of thing.
So it appears as though it's random, at least from the viewpoint of Darwin. That's not to say that it is specifically random.
No, in fact, I would say random or not, it doesn't say anything about God because God is outside of this picture. Basically, when you say random, I'm thinking, okay, you don't really have an understanding of things down to the very lowest possible level.
Well, the notion of random does not take in consideration metaphysics, in as much as what appears to be random is random, and that's fine. Random is random, but what is happening or what is potentially or possibly happening on the level that rises above what the senses can see.
Right. Well,
is creating what we understand or that we see as random happenings.
I would say it's just as easy to say that God operated through these random process of natural selection to come up with his plan. I mean
that doesn't contradict randomness.
It doesn't. Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so you had that evolution is a big thing coming into it. But you also have people applying the scientific method to religion, historical criticism, biblical criticism, all this sort of stuff.
Yeah,
And this is really where the reaction of the fundamentalists come in. You're saying nothing is true in the Bible, and we deny that, and we're going to fight against this, when we're going to fight for the literal truth.
All right, so you're saying that religious fundamentalism was actually a reaction not only to scientific positivism, but it was a reaction to using the scientific method in biblical criticism,
right,
in biblical studies, of which the Catholic Church actually uses that.
Yes. There's not to say that biblical criticism is absolutely evil or anything like that,
no.
But there was a certain people that would take certain premises in that biblical criticism that just went far beyond the sort of skepticism that they wouldn't apply anywhere else, like to history, for instance, or something like that.
Interesting.
Yeah, part of it, the problem with the excesses of the biblical criticism is that it didn't use objective reason as its guiding tool. It often brought in personal opinion. So to give a perfect example, I'm sure some people have probably heard of the Jesus Seminar, which meets periodically. And they have this group of quote-unquote theologians of various stripes who come in from all various denominations or not, and they go over various passages in the Bible, and they'll vote on whether or not, for example, they thought it really happened, or if Jesus actually said something. And to this date, I think they've only got like two passages where they thought Jesus actually said something.
Yeah.
Point being is that they're not using objective reason and reality for this. They're basing it on their own opinion. And so they basically vote with little pebbles. Well, who's to say that their reasoning is right in putting in that pebble?
Regarding the big question of evolution, Cardinal Ratzinger, who is, of course, turned into Pope Benedict XVI, himself wrote that we always need to distinguish in the Bible between form and content. Literary form and the literary content that's being communicated. And as you had mentioned, John, in the introduction to the show with Sam Poulton on Your Mother Should Know, before we came on the air, is that the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis, which relates to the creation stories and the creation of the universe, the creation of mankind, and the creation of the people of Israel, those three creation pinpoints in the first 11 chapters of Genesis are called the prehistorical stories of the Bible. They were written in a literary form that wasn't necessarily meant to be taken in a historical or scientific literary fashion the 21st century Americans would take it. It was couched in stories that would communicate profound religious truths. Now, the religious person believes that they were inspired by God, and hence they are true, but the couching of it isn't necessarily literally true. Do I have that right?
Yes, and there are examples. Even St. Augustine, who was well before evolution came along, took a look at the first two chapters of Genesis, and he said, wait a second, this currently contradicts what we know in science right now.
And this is the 300s.
This is
the 4th century.
This is actually in the 5th century, I think, is that he wrote a commentary on Genesis, and he was saying that the days don't quite match up with what we know.
So then what he had to do is he had to go beneath the surface and try to understand what the sacred author meant by day, or that term which we interpret and we translate into English as day.
And basically, St. Augustine was trying to say is don't interpret this, you know, so strictly. And in fact, if you say this to a person who knows things, he'll think that Christianity is foolishness. So don't do it this way.
But if you can, and on the scientific extreme, if you can convince a people through the media usually, and through academia, that this is what religion is. These handful of fundamentalists, let's prop them up in the media, and let's try to convince the world that this is what religion is, and now we can all collectively call it silly and go on from there.
Right. Well, they have examples like the Scopes monkey trial, and so there are those religious fundamentalists. We have to admit that they exist.
Oh, absolutely, we admit that they exist. But the idea of propping these few people up and saying this is normality, this is religion, and hence let us reject it because it's silly, there's an agenda behind that that's not genuine. It's disingenuous.
Yes, it is disingenuous. And you find that, I think, particularly now, you have you go and argue with an atheist or something like that, and they will tell you what your religion is rather than letting you explain what your religion is. They will tell you that faith is this. They will tell you that the proper interpretation of Genesis is this.
Yeah, exactly.
And
we get this all the time when we talk to folks like this.
Yes, yeah. And so...
And they have no idea what they're talking about, and they're absolutely certain they do.
But they have no idea that there's any different view out there that even precedes evolution or Galileo or whatever. There is a certain way to interpret the Bible.
So what you're saying is they're dogmatic about their views.
They are
and that's
dogmatic.
Why I call them secular fundamentalists. They don't understand that their fundamentalism is equally as non-thinking as religious fundamentalism. They don't understand that. And it's almost impossible to get through.
Yes, it does seem to be. It's like a brick wall that's put in front of you. Yes, it's very difficult to overcome, and they don't seem to listen to what you actually say when you contradict them, you know, sometimes.
Because there is a kind of blind faith there that puts a brick wall against reason. That's the problem.
I can't tell you how many times I've tried to argue and say that Christianity is not opposed to science. And the funny thing is that there's always these examples, scattered examples that come up.
And that's why I call it disingenuous.
And then you go and you find out the reason why they did this. You know, like there may be an example where Christian emperor made a decision that set that science.
Right.
But it wasn't because he was hostile to science.
Right.
But he wanted to do something. He wanted to do something else.
And you looked into the Galileo story, right?
Yes, I did.
All right. Now there was kind of bad practices on both sides of that problem, wasn't
yes,
there?
Yes, it was a complete mess throughout.
It wasn't necessarily that the church at that time was saying, we hate science, we want to suppress you. What was the real story there?
Well, Galileo was a jerk, I think is the basic ground. He was trying to...
So a good science but a jerk? A good scientist, but a jerk.
Well, he wasn't a great scientist. He made some progress. I mean, he was using telescopes and so he made some observations, and he was supporting the Copernican view.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so there was some legitimacy on his side.
Yeah.
I mean, it was. You have to remember at the time. Telescopes were brand new, so
yes.
it's not everybody had access to a telescope at the time. You know,
yeah.
You had to make your own, and
okay.
You had there was a certain skill, and so anyway, so Galileo starts teaching theology. He's saying Scripture needs to be interpreted in this way,
okay,
because of this.
Yes.
And the church said, no, you can do whatever you want with the science stuff,
yes,
but leave this stuff alone.
Okay.
And he went through two trials, and the first one he was told shut up, and then his friend became pope, and he thought, oh wow, my friend is the pope, I can start doing things, he agrees with me, he's all this,
yeah,
and he writes a book, basically painting his friend the pope as a dunce. He puts, you know, it's clear that this character is voicing the Pope's views, and that character is a dunce. And so, basically, it wasn't a very nice thing to do. So, Galileo goes through another inquisition again, another trial, and they finally say, this is it, you're under house arrest. But basically, the scientists at the time, at least the scientists that the church or the consensus was, it was that the physics were this way. The Earth was the center of the universe, and everybody who said differently was wrong.
Okay.
And obviously, those scientists were wrong,
yep.
And the church was wrong. But it wasn't the church wasn't trying to make a determination based on that. It was basically an overreaction to what Galileo was doing.
Yeah. And I think it's important to note that, and correct me if I'm wrong, but both Copernicus and Galileo were both Catholic.
Yes, they were. Yeah. And
Copernicus was a priest.
Copernicus was a Catholic priest.
And his bishop urged him to publish early, but he decided he wanted it to happen after his death.
I think it's also important to point out, too, that even if there were reactions among certain churchmen,
yeah.
against things perhaps that Galileo said or did not say, the important thing to note is that their reactions were never doctrinal or dogmatic in nature.
Right, sure.
They were personal opinions by people and were not in any way related to official teaching of the church.
You're right. They weren't official teaching of the church, and obviously it did not fall under the gift of infallibility that the church
And eventually the Catholic Church reversed its position on the Galileo affair.
And Pope John Paul II in was around the year 2000.
He apologized.
He apologized for any wrongdoing that his predecessors contributed to that situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to paint a picture, you know, the Catholic Church is completely innocent here and Galileo is a hero like the secular fundamentalists try to do.
And I would, you know what I would say? I would say that there is no them versus us in this because both parties were Catholic. Galileo
right.
was a Catholic, was part of the
and
Catholic Church, was Copernicus.
And he remained a faithful Catholic even
right.
after his house arrest.
Right. Right.
There's a book out there talking about his correspondence to his daughter, who is a religious part of a religious order, a nun or something like that. So he kept his faith throughout the entire time.
Many other scientists in the Middle Ages and the early modern age were also Catholic. Maybe we'll get into that, but we need to first take a break, and we'll get into more of this this question of evolution and other questions that you might have in mind. 978-454-4980 is our phone number. You're listening to Beneath the Surface here on WCAP Radio, where everybody gets it. I'm Paul Morano. We've got a good solid 16 minutes left of this show, so come back after this break. We'll be here.
Did you know that the child sitting next to yours in school or your elder neighbor is experiencing hunger? Hunger is a reality for people right here in our community. I'm Amy Pessia, Executive Director of the Merrimack Valley Food Bank. The food bank works with food pantries, shelters, and meal programs in the Merrimack Valley and beyond to get food to nearly 70,000 people monthly. To find out how you can help, visit mvfb.org or call 978-454-7272.
Are you pregnant, scared, overwhelmed, or feeling pressured? There is free, confidential caring help available to you. You're not alone. Call Heartbeat at 781-229-7887.
Heartbeat made me feel comfortable and was supportive.
I received so much help from them.
They were understanding, not judgmental.
It was a warm, friendly, supportive atmosphere. They did not judge.
If you are in the midst of an unintended pregnancy, need help, or are seeking answers, you're not alone. Heartbeat is there for you, confidentially and without judgment. Pick up the phone and call 781-229-7887. You'll be so happy you did. That's 781-229-7887. Heartbeat Pregnancy Help Center. People you can trust. 781-229-7887.
And welcome back. Thank you for going beneath the surface with us tonight. My name is Paul Morano. You're listening to BTS Radio on 980 WCAP, where everybody gets it, at least everybody who is still awake. And speaking of still awake, I see two awake heads right in front of my face, Mr. John Tudoris, and who is now he is now acting like a bobblehead because I said I have two awake heads, and Mr. Robert LeBlanc. You don't do a bobblehead all that well.
No.
No. By the way, John, before we get to any more serious stuff, can I have an impersonation or two? You do such great voices.
Which one are you looking
give
for?
Give me a president. Any president.
I did not inhale.
All right, give me another president.
Because it's about freedom. And freedom fries and freedom-y stuff.
All right, thank you. I needed that. All right. So, getting back to our show tonight on science and religion, and of course the intersecting element between both of those, which is philosophy. Last hour, before we were rudely interrupted by necessary means of keeping us existing, in other words, commercials. We were talking about the scientific method, and we were talking about how the controversial issues affect us today that have happened in the past, and we found it ironic that they were kind of just infighting, not infighting, they were family squabbles, if you will, of Christians talking about how best to interpret scriptures and how best to understand the world around us. Now, I understand we mentioned last hour that both Copernicus and Galileo were faithful Catholics, and I also understand, guys, that most of what we know today, at least a lot of the milestones in modern science in the modern age, Middle Ages and the modern age, were discovered and made known to the masses by Catholic scientists.
Yes.
Give me a few examples.
Well, one good one, especially since we're talking about evolution, is is Gregor Mendel, who laid down the foundation for genetics.
Okay.
And basically, you need modern genetics is one of the supports for evolution as we understand it right now. Darwin's theory of evolution was actually falling out of favor because it wasn't quite an adequate answer until the conversion of genetics kind of explained, oh, this is how everything works.
Yeah, it kind of made more sense of things.
Yeah,
on a micro level.
Yeah, this is what Mendel was doing. He was doing some experiments on his own. He was part of a religious order doing experiments.
So he was a religious brother, a Catholic brother?
Yeah, Mendel? An Augustinian monk, I believe.
Okay. All right, what else?
Well, another big one would be Father George Lemaître, a Belgian priest who concocted the idea of the Big Bang.
I see.
So,
he was Catholic, wasn't he?
Which you will find in almost any one who adheres to scientism will almost inevitably in conversation bring up the Big Bang.
Okay.
And that was concocted by a Catholic priest.
Okay. Interesting. Any others?
Another would be Nicholas Steneau, who would be the father of geology. So like rock formations, all that jazz. He was a Catholic convert, which interestingly enough, he started off a Lutheran in his travels. He was also a famed anatomist of his day. And for example, he discovered tear ducts in people.
Okay.
It sounds mundane,
but
considering before then, people thought tears were leaking brain fluid.
Okay.
That's probably a good idea to discover those.
Yeah.
And anyway, he ended up in Italy with the Medici court, which was, by the way, Catholic and very favorable to scientists. One of the Medicis would actually bankroll them for all their scientific experiments. And it was actually there that he converted to Catholicism, eventually became a bishop, and is now a blessed.
Isaac Newton, he was a faithful man, wasn't he?
He was Anglican, but he might have been Unitarian.
Okay.
So he was more of a deist type of guy.
How about Pascal?
Pascal was a Catholic.
Pascal.
Pascal is like a lot of people. He's a philosopher. Did a lot of math. And stuff. Descartes is kind of the same thing.
Was a Catholic. Was he a Catholic priest?
He was a Catholic, a secular Catholic.
Okay.
We name the Cartesian coordinate system after him in math.
Interesting.
Oh, and there's Louis Pasteur, pasteurization.
Oh, Louis Pasteur. Yes.
Yeah.
He created pasteurization so that we can drink milk without getting sick.
Yeah.
Is that how that works? Okay.
Yeah. Actually, the guy who came up, I forget his name, who came up with a cure for malaria.
Yeah.
Was Catholic.
Okay.
Actually, the idea for the cure came to him while he was praying the rosary.
Okay.
Yeah, I wish I remembered his name, but I thought that was an interesting story.
Very interesting. And Albert Einstein, who was Jewish, one of my favorite lines of Einstein, it's one of his quotes, "I want to know God's thoughts, the rest are details," unquote.
Yeah. He's kind of an interesting sort of character because there's a little bit of a doubt with whether he believed in God or not. I mean,
he was a questioning sort of guy. Yeah, he was a searching kind of guy.
Yeah.
Not only scientifically but religiously. And it seems like if you put all of his quotes together, and again, we don't know at different parts of his life, he probably favored different things religiously. We don't know what he believed on his deathbed. But it seemed like he believed in a kind of universal God that wasn't necessarily personal, but existed was responsible for the universe.
It's kind of funny. Like he would make a statement that God doesn't throw die. This was in reference, I think, to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. He just couldn't accept that, which is kind of interesting since we were talking about randomness. I don't see any reason why God wouldn't throw die, I suppose. at that level. Randomness is maybe what God chooses to work through, at least what appears random to us.
What appears random to us, absolutely. Yeah. And so there's no problem with the notion of something appearing to be random. Right?
I'd buy that.
Now, regarding, of course, the Big Bang Theory, which is accepted by a lot of people today, whether they, you know, whether they're scientists or not, a lot of people are, you know, why not? The Big Bang Theory is interesting because it is a, obviously, it says that something banged, but it doesn't, what to me is obvious here is that if you're going to go before that, you're getting into the non-scientific realm. In other words, the question, where did this original dense material that's, you know, is so infinitesimal in size but so great in weight where did this come from?
Yeah.
Well, why did it bang? And, you know, where did the original matter of the Big Bang theory?
Well, here's the interesting thing, Paul, about the Big Bang is that it suggests a beginning.
Yes.
That's not what the long-term view of scientists were before the Big Bang. Many people thought that the universe always was. And here you have somebody suggesting, well, wait a minute, there was a beginning, which kind of converges a little bit with the view of Genesis. But even George Lemaitre, he suggested, I think, when the Pope at the time said, all right, we've got a theory that's going for us, he actually cautioned the Pope and said, no, just don't go too far with this. This is, you know, this is when we're really talking about science, we're not talking about something that is really absolutely settled. It's the best model that we have at the current time, but it can be overturned at any time when new information comes along.
Now, the great philosopher Peter Kreeft said something that just is very simple but very commonsensical, and that is, if there's a Big Bang, then there must be a Big Banger.
Yes, yes.
Okay. Boom, boom, hey.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me.
Oh,
who and what banged and for what purpose? And where did the original banging stuff come from?
Well,
those are the questions I'd like to know.
That's the Callum cosmological argument, basically. You know, if something has a beginning, something caused it.
Yeah. 2 minutes left, gentlemen. Is that right, producer Chris?
About a minute and a half.
A minute and a half. Okay. Thanks for this conversation. Do you want to say anything as a closing thought, John or Bob?
Well, I think maybe to just to restate what you were saying about faith, that faith is not something that is merely blind, but that is something reasonable. And the fact is that we do have faith in a lot of things. It's not merely pure reason itself.
And I'll just add one more thing. For those who are stuck on their own ideas of what they think faith is and what they're arguing against, be a little humble and recognize that you don't know everything and get out of your wheelhouse and be receptive. And that's actually what science is all about. So if you want to know true science, if you want to know what faith really is, if you want to know what reason is, be observant and be receptive.
Faith, reason, and science, the three avenues to truth. All complimenting each other and helping each other get there. Thank you, gentlemen. John Tudoris, Bob LeBlanc. Good to have you back here beneath the surface. You have been listening to Beneath the Surface. My name is Paul Morano. Thanks for staying with us. And I guess I'll talk to you next week.
Hello, this is international Catholic singer Anna Nuzzo, inviting you to join me and Father Dan Cambra of the Marian Fathers on a select international tours Divine Mercy pilgrimage to Poland and the Czech Republic. It takes place in September of 2019, and we would love for you to join us. For more information, go to my website, annanuzzo.com. Thank you, and God bless.
The
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at KaneFord.com.